With me here today is the director of the Kalamazoo Singers, Rick Phelps. Rick, it's nice to have you back at WMUK.
Thanks. It is always so much fun to be here with you, Kara.
Well, you have something in store for us on Sunday. The concert's at 3 o'clock at First Presbyterian Church. All right, well, let's get started. Tell us about this program.
This concert is called The People Sing, Folk Songs and Spirituals. And it's a continuation of our theme for the year, really, which is the voice. Now, you might think, well, of course, you're a choir, so isn't that like assumed, right? Everything you do is singing. It's all about the voice. But it's more about the way the voice has become the choir through various different genres of music. So, for example, the Christmas concert was all jazz. Jazz is a uniquely American voice. It grew up here. It was polished here, and it has thrived here. And in fact, as you know, right here at Western Michigan University, vocal jazz is a huge part of the history of the music of this school. And so we dedicated an entire concert to that uniquely American voice, jazz. Well, this next concert is just the music of the people. Folk songs have no composers. There's no nobody sits down and writes a song and says, "Hey, look, I have this new folk song." You know, they might go to the bar and by the end of the time, the patrons are singing along a song that they've either all made up, or it's just a song that they've been singing their whole lives and they don't know where it came from. And that's really the essence of a folk song. And they're universal. You can find organically grown folk songs in every culture across the world. And then the spiritual, you could think of it as a folk song that grew out of the American slave South, with techniques and melodies and rhythms and energies from Africa, turned into just amazing, amazing music. But again, no composer. The songs just grew.
Somebody wrote them at some point, right? Or somebody came up with the song as they're working, or the tune as they're working. And maybe it became known as Joe Smith's song for a while, but then it just became everybody's song?
That's possible, although in some cases we think that they just appeared and really had nobody responsible. It could have grown out of the rhythm of working in a field. It could have grown out of, people sitting around a campfire and just singing, and they say, "Hey, this is a nice tune," or something. But we really have it's a bit like Ancestry.com. You can go so far and then you can't go any farther back, right? Some people, like my family, were able to trace our history, you know, 1,000 years. But most people can't. They can only go back a few generations, maybe just to this side of the Atlantic. Maybe they can get across the ocean. But with this music, we can trace the origins only so far, and then the trail goes cold.
Well, tell me some of the pieces on the program. How will you begin?
We are going to be singing just some of the great, wonderful songs that many, many people know. For example, you can't do a song or a concert of folk songs without Danny Boy. So Danny Boy is featured prominently. The Sally Gardens is another beautiful English folk song. An American folk song that we're excited to do is Shenandoah. And that's one that has been arranged. I mean, that melody, goodness, has been probably set by 100, maybe 1,000 different composers. I don't know. I think in the catalog right now, there are easily 100 different arrangements of Shenandoah currently available for purchase.
Quit that tune.
You know, sometimes these tunes, they're so infectious and they're so beautiful that it doesn't matter how many attempts at setting it, I'll say perfectly, everyone thinks, "I can bring something new." And you know what? They're often right. The melodies are so beautiful. And I just think that great composers, great arrangers, take that material and just apply their own genius to it and come up with something something wonderfully new and fresh, and they never seem old.
Do you have a favorite arrangement of Shenandoah that you'll be performing Sunday?
This one that we'll be performing is certainly a favorite. I'm not sure if it is the favorite of mine.
It's not a singular.
That's right. That's right. There are other versions, other arrangements. There's a men's chorus arrangement that I particularly love, and I forget the composer offhand. But this one is by James Erb, and it is extremely popular. The tune is presented, and then this wonderful foundation sung by the tenor and bass underneath the melody, and then you have the sense of waves crashing, not crashing even, just rolling onto the shore over and over and over, and you can imagine the turning of wagon wheels as people from the Shenandoah Valley rode wagons across the plains. They're reminded, they're longing of, for their homeland, not even homeland, home state, home farm. Just the beautiful region of Virginia. And they took this music with them across the plains. And the ending of this arrangement, you can just feel the wheels turning and the music coming at you in wave after wave after wave. It's especially beautiful.
This is reminding me of a conversation I had with a folk musician named Joel Mabus, whose last album was called Different Hymnals, and it brought together his arrangements for solo guitar and some singing of sort of sacred pieces. But the interesting thing to him was how often, the tune would exist and then the words would be set by a completely different person in a completely different century. He kept researching and trying to find the first instances of these things, but it is quite hard. And yet that's kind of the beauty of it, because no one takes full credit for it. It's kind of all of ours. That's folk music.
Yeah. I think that's why it's called folk music, folk songs, because nobody really can take credit for it. Also, folk meaning the people. Again, it's a worldwide phenomenon. So there are folk songs that in a way define Japanese culture and history, define the Korean sound, define what we imagine in our ears when we think of Chinese music. There are folk songs that define Hungarian sounds. It's across the world. It's in every culture. And they're so human and they're so beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you said, people brought here in slavery brought music with them that is now considered fully American music. And I'm hoping you would tell us about an instance of that that's appearing on the Sunday program.
Right. So we have several spirituals that we'll be singing, some that are, well, really all of them that I think are very well known. Every Time I Feel the Spirit is a classic by William Dawson. Sooner We'll Be Done with the Troubles of the World is another of his arrangements. He was at Tuskegee Institute in Alabama and was not the first, but was one of the first great exponents of popularizing the African-American spiritual. And we've sort of seen the growth of arranging these marvelous melodies in waves. So he would have been part of the early or first wave. Most recently, you've had people like Moses Hogan, who has a, I don't know, maybe 40 different arrangements of spirituals, some of the same ones that Dawson worked with, some of the same material, but again, a fresh voice, very much like, you know, the many editions or many arrangements of Shenandoah. There are multiple arrangements of Joshua Fit the Battle of Jericho. We will be singing the Hogan arrangement of that, but you can find others that are just as grand. Another one that's one of our favorites is called Witness, and that's been treated by several different arrangers, composers, but we'll be doing Jack Halloran's, which is very exciting. It has several different sections. It's got different rhythmic features. There's a swung section. There's a section where the women of the choir get very seductive as they're playing the role of Delilah, trying to seduce Samson and get him to tell the secret of his great strength. So that piece captures a lot of different musical elements while being true to the same tune and the same telling of the whole story of Witness.
The concert, again, is Sunday at 3 o'clock, and it's held at First Presbyterian Church in downtown Kalamazoo. That's a venue you've used several times before, including this concert season.
Yes, this is actually our second concert this season. The Christmas concert, the jazz concert, was there, and this one will be. We also did last year's Christmas concert where we did the Morton Lordson Lux Aeterna. And by the way, having said that, you know, that's one of the great things about the Kalamazoo Singers is that a year ago we did this concert of what's become a staple of the classical choral repertoire, the Lux Aeterna. And a year later, in the same building, we turn around and sing a concert of all jazz. So the versatility, the ability of our singers to tackle repertoire from all across the choral spectrum is really amazing, really, really remarkable. We don't specialize in anything, but we make everything special.
It's like Kalamazoo Singers Unlimited.
There you go. That's good.
KSU.
Yeah.
And you've said, you know, the members actually don't like being forced into one channel for an entire concert even. The variety is part of the appeal.
That's right. And even though we're singing, you know, spirituals and folk songs, the variety within them, we have fast ones, we have silly ones, we have passionate ones, we have profound ones. They're, you know, it covers the gamut of human emotion, of human experience.
It's my experience with folk music has to do with the Irish tradition mostly, and you know, you can group a lot of these songs into, like, love songs, drinking songs, and often songs of emigration or leaving home. That is a huge theme in a lot of these. What are some other themes that you might recognize?
Well, there's, you know, in the spirituals, obviously the word spirit, these are mostly reflections of the African-American approach to biblical stories. These are their way of telling the story, keeping the story alive. There is some considerable evidence that spirituals were also sung as coded language to alert slaves of an event, whether it was time to flee or time to stay or do this, don't do that. And so the spiritual has more meaning than just the religious or biblical significance in the story. But they all tell part of the story. I mean, it's just unavoidable. On the other hand, one of our folk songs called Chingering Cha, which is set by Aaron Copland.
We've heard of him.
That's right. obviously, a huge seminal figure in American music in the throughout the 20th century, but let's say the first half, let's say the first 50 years, he was most influential. This Chingering Cha comes out kind of as a nonsense song until you get halfway through, and then you realize you're singing about the promised land, you're singing about glory, you're singing about heaven, and you don't. It sort of sucks you into it, and you don't even realize, oh, that's what I'm singing about. You know, the it's nonsense at the first. Chingering Cha, Chingering Ching, Hoeding Kumlarki, Chingering Ching Ching, Hoeding Kumlarki, and then you get this key word, brothers. Well, that's immediately significant for religious ideas. So brothers gather around, listen to the story about the promised land and the promised glory. And suddenly you're transported from nonsense singing, Chingering Cha, into something that is a very personal religious expression from the people who sang the song.
Do you feel as a choral conductor that it is kind of your job to know a little more than just the score, but if you're going to, you know, prepare it with a group of people, that the history, the traditions need to be communicated to some extent as well?
Yes. Yes. To some extent. And I wish it were so much more. And, you know, other conductors are better at teaching the choir the meaning of this and the history of that and so forth. I always admire people who can get the job of teaching the music done and get the job of teaching the story behind the music all in the same amount of time. And I'm scratching my head saying, how did you get so much work done in such a short rehearsal, right? But there is that element of you have to know enough about what you're singing, enough about what you're talking about to make it relevant.
Yeah, I feel like I've had this discussion recently where we're talking about, you can really tell when, say, a performer of one genre attempts music of another genre and everything sounds like just a really bad accent or something. So these traditions have to kind of build up in your own ear. Authenticity in music is an interesting topic and something that you can work on your entire life.
Yes. That's one thing I do talk to the singers about all the time. I use words like integrity and honesty. We need to sing a Palestrina motet just as honestly as we would sing one of these spirituals. We can't bring second-rate effort. We can't bring second-rate feeling. We can't have a second-rate opinion necessarily of the music as music per se. Some of the songs we sing are very complicated. Some of the songs we sing are very easy. Does that make one better than the other or of more value? I don't think so, but there has to be a way to communicate that every single if we're going to spend any time at all with a piece of music, we ought to give it our best or we ought not to do it at all. That's really the fundamental thing. So, you know, we're already deep into planning next season. And if we want to do, we're most likely going to be doing a Baroque Christmas concert next year. Mm. So if we're going to sing Bach, we'd better be ready to sing Bach really well. If we're going to sing Handel, we'd better be prepared to sing Handel really, really well. Last year, during our 40th anniversary season, when we did our choral classics concert, where we hired a wonderful orchestra and did some of the greatest single pieces in the history of music. For example, the Hallelujah Chorus. The Hallelujah Chorus has been done so many times, you know, hundreds of thousands of performances around the globe, thousands each year. Well, if you're going to do a piece like that, you had better well do it well. And I think we were able to bring a lot of life to a very tried and true piece that can become hackneyed if it's just sung. If you just sing it through, if you don't really look at it, then I think you do the piece injustice. You do disservice to the work of art and to the composer.
I can picture you speaking this kind of intensely about the piece before you pick up the baton and the it certainly, it's making me sit up in my seat and want to pay attention and feel like the job of making music is very important. You know,
it is important, and yet we mustn't take ourselves too seriously. So there's a balancing act. But I really passionately believe in being honest to the composers and their intentions. I don't know where I picked this up from. I think it was from my graduate professor, Dr. Elmer Thomas at the University of Cincinnati. I think he's the one that put into words what I had thought but not been able to articulate. And it goes something along the lines of this. I've been blessed, Dr. Thomas said, I've been blessed my whole life to spend time with and become good friends with Mozart and Bach and Stravinsky and Brahms. He didn't view the music as just sort of something that existed off on its own. He viewed it as the true expression of the soul that created it. And I really have taken those words to heart. And so when I study music, or I love to read philosophy and to understand the great ideas of the world, when you do that, I really truly believe you're sitting in the presence of genius. When you open up the book and read it, when you open up a piece of music and study it, examine it, or listen to it, that you're in the presence of a great mind, a mind that created something that you can wrap your mind around, that you can grasp. And we owe it to the composer and our audiences to do that, to do a service.
And another way of thinking about it, perhaps, is not all of our relationships are with living people.
That's exactly right. You can have a relationship with the mind of someone else who has put work down that you can go and examine. Different than visual art. You know, when we examine visual art, it is there. It is static. It's on the wall. It's amazing. It's awe-inspiring. I've stood on the steps of the Parthenon in Athens and been in awe of the symmetry of the building. And it's up on the hill. You can see all of Athens before you. It's really awe-inspiring. But the thing that is so beautiful about music is that I cannot build the Parthenon, but I can build music. I can recreate what some other genius has so lovingly crafted, and I can teach my singers, my orchestra, whatever I'm working with, I can teach them that music, and we can recreate what that person has put down on paper. And that is an amazing gift. It's an amazing experience. It is joyful. It is unparalleled. I can't paint worth a lick. I can't draw worth a lick, but I can paint music. I can make music, and I love that gift.
Well, and here's where to remind listeners that the concert will be Sunday at 3 at First Presbyterian Church. And I guess lastly, I'd ask for your thoughts. I think kind of alluded to it earlier by saying some music can be complicated and difficult, and sometimes that's given more value than music that is more humble and straightforward. Folk music is often given that. It's considered simple, just not given the same status as your pieces from, say, the classical world. And I think a lot about how in so many ways, that's not quite, I wish that weren't the paradigm that we were working with.
I do too. There is something to be said about a Bach, or I can't believe I'm going to say this in the same breath, but a Bach or a Rutter, who each of whom is able to spin a melody like nobody's business. You know, those two, their melodies are really, really beautiful. And they are originally composed directly from the mind of those men. There's also something to be said about these beautiful melodies. We don't know exactly where they came from, but their simplicity and their singableness make them very, very attractive and beautiful all on their own. And I can think of three, there are more, but there are three significant composers in music history who thought that the folk song was the be-all, end-all. You have, I suppose, first would have been Dvorak, pursuing, researching, and either trying to write music that was folk-like or taking songs and turning them into symphonies. You have Kodály and Bartók researching the Hungarian countryside and trying to capture before they were lost.
With early recording technology.
Early recording devices. Yeah. Who did it in England? I can't remember if it was Vaughan Williams who went out and recorded.
Yes, he did.
And someone else. And so a lot of these songs were preserved by just having, you know, Joe Fisherman from the bar come and sing the song and it would be recorded. And Copland himself, we mentioned him already. He was very associated with the American folk song and incorporated it into his music. And if he wasn't writing using an exact tune, then he was writing a tune himself that sounded like a folk song. Beautiful, wonderful stuff. And these are not run-of-the-mill composers. You know, Dvorak, Bartók, and Vaughan Williams and Copland are not just throwaway composers. As you said, you know, sometimes we look at folk music as throwaway music. These are great composers. And the folk song was a big deal to them.
Yeah. And Dvorak was right here on American soil saying, you young American composers need to listen to the music all around you right now and use that as your inspiration. Words that are still impacting today. Yeah. Great.
That's right.
And let's not forget Brahms either. I think he would say, hello, I was I was writing down these Hungarian Roma melodies. Well, I guess that takes care of our time today, actually. And maybe you could pick out one to leave us with to anticipate Sunday's program.
Well, there are so many, but I would say let's listen to The Battle of Jericho by Moses Hogan.
Thanks, Rick. Nice to have you here again.
My pleasure as always. I look forward to the next time.
Joshua fit the battle of Jericho. Joshua fit the battle of Jericho. Joshua
fit the battle of Jericho.
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 The battle of Jericho. The battle of Jericho, Joshua fit the battle of Jericho, Joshua
fit the battle of Jericho,
the battle of Jericho,
the battle of
Jericho,
the battle of Jericho,
the battle of Jericho,
the battle of Jericho,
the battle of Jericho, the battle of Jericho, Joshua fit the battle of Jericho.
Talk about your kings of Gibeon,
go on, you can talk about
your men of Saul,
go on, yes, you can talk about your
good old Joshua at the battle of Jericho.
That morning, Joshua,
the battle of Jericho,
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 the battle of the battle of Jericho, Joshua, the battle of Jericho,
right up to the walls of Jericho,
Jericho,
he marched with spear in hand,
the Lord
Joshua ran on, Joshua cried,
cause the battle lamb in my hand, God Almighty,
then the lamb ran, she pointed his to blow,
and the
trumpet.